Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
Show broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. Fukushima irradiated and everybody has a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. I'm Vinny Eastwood. My very special guest today, and everybody will notice that I always say my very special guest. And have you noticed how every human being, you know, kind of seems to be very special in their own way, you know, whether that be being special in the retarded sense of the word, or being special as in the gold that you found on the side of the road, and nobody else seems to want to claim it, you know? Beautiful. Thank you very much. I'll add that wealth to my chest. Anthony Peake, welcome to the program.
Hello, Vincent. How are you? Do you go by Vinny, don't you?
Yeah.
Right. Hello, Vinny.
I have many names ascribed to me, kind of like the devil. Would you tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
Who I am and what I do? Well, there's a million-dollar question. I'm a writer based in the UK, and for the last 10 years I've been focusing in on writing a series of books about human consciousness and how it relates to reality. Effectively, I started off with a fascination about the phenomenon that is generally known as déjà vu, or more technically termed déjà vécu, and I've always been intrigued as to exactly what is happening when I have déjà vu sensations. And around about 10 years ago, I was in the position that I could spend some time writing a book on the subject. And a year later, I ended up writing my first book. It was called Is There Life After Death? The Extraordinary Science of What Happens When You Die. And effectively, in that book, I came up with a fairly astonishing hypothesis about what happens to human consciousness at the point of death, which is to many degrees scientifically valid in the sense that I'm not one of these guys that comes around and makes extreme claims. I'm not somebody who claims that I'm actually channeling information from the planet Tharg. I'm not talking to 15,000-year-old Atlanteans or people from Lemuria. I'm actually the real deal, and I deal with a lot of very, very serious scientists around the world, including neurologists and psychologists and such like. And I genuinely believe that what I have to offer has a degree of logic to a lot of people, in the sense that now I'm in the process of now finishing my sixth book, and I've got somewhere in the region of 40,000 sales of books behind me now with various foreign language translations. And indeed, I'm off to Zagreb in a few weeks' time to do a book launch over there for the first Croatian edition of my first book. So basically, I'm just a seeker after truth, a little bit like you guys are. And sometimes I feel that sometimes I'm getting dangerously near to something that, well, I definitely seem to be joining the dots, let's say, in terms of what I'm trying to do.
When you say dangerously near to something, do you think that there's any inherent danger in what you're doing?
People have warned me that this is the case, basically because if what I write about is correct, then the things I write about have been known for a long, long time by the elites. These are things that have been kept secret either within esoteric belief systems, within various secret societies and such like. But effectively, my next book, I'm dealing with the pineal gland, the endogenous generation of dimethyltryptamine within the brain, and I've been coming up with some surprising parallels between what I'm finding out now and some of the things that have been taught within esoteric areas of Masonic belief systems for centuries. For instance, the idea of Kundalini awakening, how that works neurologically, these kind of things.
What is the Kundalini awakening? Because a lot of people would think it's some kind of pasta meal.
They could, couldn't they? Probably it could be a severe form of indigestion, and I suspect that many people that do have Kundalini awakenings are actually probably after a bad curry a couple of days before. But basically what a Kundalini awakening is the sensation that you feel something is searing up your spine, from the bottom of your spine right up your spinal cord to the center of your brain, when there's suddenly this incredibly explosive feeling in the center of the brain, as if you're suddenly accessing information from places that ordinarily you wouldn't be able to do so. In other words, I argue with you, you're going deeply inward in terms of drawing up information from something called the zero-point field, the quantum energy field. And again, sounds...
You talked about this as though it's a field and almost a shiver coming up your spine, the hairs on the back of your neck standing up and things of that nature. And something that popped into my mind there is that actually at dance parties and festivals and things of that nature, when musicians are playing incredibly loud and they have songs with a lot of power and meaning, etc., that kind of feeling is something that I have actually experienced in those situations, because it's almost as though a sound field has resonated with me somehow and made me remember something. Do you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. Funnily enough, one of the people that I'm associated with is a guy who works in Montreux in Switzerland, and he's been working using sonics, and he has this incredible hi-fi system where he uses sound to generate and make the brain vibrate in a particular way, which actually is an argument to say, again, can actually start generating endogenous dimethyltryptamine, in which case you start to have these strange sensations. Of course, shamanic drumming is something that does a similar thing. It's the idea if you get repetitive beats in a certain way, they will make the brain resonate in a certain way. And when these resonations hit a certain level, the brain starts to generate certain neurotransmitters, which then opens up a portal into alternate realities, for want of a better term. You know, effectively, we start to perceive things that we ordinarily don't. Now, funnily enough, I did a radio interview with one of Ireland's top DJs a few weeks ago, and we were discussing off-air this very idea of music and sound and how this works. Because if you look at it anthropologically, you know, people have been dancing into forms of frenzy, for want of a better term, for millennia. And it clearly does bring about this sensation. Now, again, guys that are in the clubbing world will also know something called the K-hole and ketamine, and how ketamine brings about out-of-the-body experiences. And my previous book was, in fact, about the out-of-the-body experience and how that is generated neurochemically. So there is a lot of truth in what you're saying there. And I know from when I was younger, when I used to go clubbing and things, and going to festivals, I know the sensation you get, you know, and I do know you do go somewhere else. It's a trance state almost. Well, that's why that kind of music's called trance, isn't it?
Well, and again, if that is a possibility, then have there been any experiments or programs of such a nature where they would roll through the spectrum of sound frequency to test the reactions to each frequency on the brain to see which one or if many of them tap into this higher form of consciousness?
There is. There's been work done by a guy called Michael Persinger at the Laurentian University in Sudbury in Canada. And what he's been doing, he's been working with certain resonances of sound. What he did is quite intriguing. What Persinger did was he took, I think it was an American football helmet, and what he did was he placed electrodes inside the helmet and stimulated areas of the brain with subsonic sound. And he was able to generate in certain people something he called the sense presence. And it was the idea that somebody was close by, somebody was standing close to them. And, of course, this is very much related to sleep paralysis, the sensation when you're in this semi-hypnagogic, semi-awake, semi-asleep state that you sense that there's something else in the room. It's called the hag, and the idea that there's something else there. Now, Persinger came to a fascinating conclusion that he decided that this would explain a lot of hauntings, because they found that many hauntings are actually located in houses that either have running water underneath them or have something to do with the electricity system or the central heating system that resonates at a certain level, which actually stimulates the brain to have these sensations, specifically the temporal lobes of the brain. And this is why people who experience something called temporal lobe epilepsy have these sensations all the time. And in fact, I'm in contact with quite a few temporal lobe epileptics around the world who regularly have these sensations and feelings. So clearly it is to do with sound. It's also to do with light. There are certain resonations of light that can actually stimulate these things as well. Also, deep meditation can bring them about. So it's not just exclusively particular sensations. It's a mixture of the sensations, and these all can bring about these alternate states of consciousness.
So what about if there's, say, intersecting fields, like, let's say, one's a resonating frequency-type field, yeah, and another one's a temperature, and another one, so on and so forth. One of them's food, one of them's water. Does that mean that perhaps there is a balance to be struck here at some point between what your diet is, how much water you're drinking, what kind of music you're listening to, and what kind of people you're associating with, what kind of thoughts are going through your head, what kind of media you're absorbing? And I was just thinking about this the other day, is that as somebody who understands about the New World Order and 9/11's an inside job and what have you, there's an inherent kind of scariness with the adjunct of the information. And what becomes apparent to me is that once your eyes are opened to this new reality, you cannot close them again. Similar to how Neo in The Matrix was woken up and cannot be plugged in, because once you have been plugged back in, despite the fact that you eat that steak and it tastes juicy and delicious, you know that it is a lie, and you cannot enjoy something that is a lie, no matter how delicious it is. And that can be, I think, a metaphor for having an awakening, just in general, any whether it be a spiritual or an intellectual awakening. Do you think so?
I think in many ways it's more than a metaphor, in the sense that if you go into the background of the Wachowski brothers and the reason why they did the Matrix movie, it's profoundly Gnostic, and it's dealing with Gnostic belief systems and the idea that what we exist in is Maya. It's an illusion. It's a brain-generated illusion. Now, either it's generated by our own brains or it's generated externally to us. Now, effectively, I have recently been asked by my publisher to write a new biography of the American science fiction writer Philip K. Dick. And if you read a lot of the Philip K. Dick work, and which I've been immersing myself in over the last few years, what you'll effectively find is that's one of the things he argues about, is what is real, what is the nature of reality. Because if you think about it, the only way we perceive reality is through our five senses. And, of course, the reality itself is processed by the brain. It's presented by the brain to consciousness, whatever that is, whatever it is inside your head, the little homunculus, that the little man in the brain that supposedly processes everything receives all the information secondhand, to the extent, for instance, that even if you look at sight and you realize that as you're looking out now, there is a blind spot, and your brain consistently covers up that blind spot. Now, ironically enough, a few months ago, I was discussing this very issue with my optician when I was explaining to him, and I was saying the kind of stuff I write about human perception and how perception is perceived in the brain. And I said, one of the most intriguing things is about the blind spot. And he turned around to me and he seriously said, we can explain the blind spot. You have stereo vision. As you look through both of your eyes, the eyes superimpose the image to give you a full screen. And I said, so what happens when I close one eye then? And he looked at me and he went, I'd never thought about that. And that is the way people think. They get received wisdom. Even professional people like that never think about that. They think the explanation of the blind spot is because we have stereo vision. So why, when we close one eye, do we still not see the blind spot? And what happens is the brain makes up the information from around it to give you the full picture. Now, consciousness studies individuals around the world have a term they use for this belief that the reality we perceive is the reality that's outside. They call it naive realism. And naive realism is what 95% of the population out there believe. It's not as it is. If you think about it, a photon of light hits an object, bounces off the object, enters your eye. It then goes through the lens of the eye, and as it does so, what technically happens is that photon hits an electron and causes that electron to, it absorbs that light and causes another electron and gives that electron to give off another photon. And that does through your aqueous humor in your eye, back to the retina of the eye. That signal is then turned into an electrical signal, which is then sent down your optic nerve to your visual cortex of your brain. It is then processed in the visual cortex and then is presented to consciousness as a picture. The photon has long gone. The original photon has long gone. The original picture has long gone. So what you're perceiving is not what's out there. A guy called Richard L. Gregory is one of the world's leading authorities on perception studies. And if you ever get the opportunity, he actually writes a book about vision and the mysteries of vision. When people pretend they understand vision, they don't. They haven't got the vaguest idea of how our vision works.
Well, I think this is starting to be one of the most interesting interviews we've had on this show. So stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be back in about 3 or 4 minutes with my very special guest, Anthony Peake from anthonypeake.com. That's P-E-A-K-E, anthonypeake.com. You can get his books there and the rest of the stuff as well. A lot of material available there. We'll be right back at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com.
Some kind of way out of here.
We'll be right back.
There's too much confusion.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinny Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, broadcasting live on AM/FM stations across the United States. We also have wonderful affiliates here in New Zealand, Rush FM in Hamilton and iFinity FM in the South Island. And also, ladies and gentlemen, I wanted to share with you an idea I had. I don't know if it has any validity, but you know how... have you ever heard the story of Johnny Appleseed, Anthony? Anthony, are you there?
Oh, you're asking me? Yeah, I have.
All right. Dude, and for those of you who are unfamiliar, dude figured out that there were a hell of a lot of, problems with people being fed or getting decent alcohol around the United States or whatever. So he cruises around and he's just planting seeds all over the place, just planting seeds. And sure enough, you know, apples abundant. People have got their apple pie, apple cider, apple this, apple that. They got everything they need, okay? Now, think about that, but instead of planting seeds in a literal sense, think about it as planting seeds in an intellectual or a, more to the point, a technological media sense. That's what I wanted to do, is travel the world, you know, and stay at somebody's house or whatever, you know, just plug in my Mac and my microphone and whatever, and do the show, and be there for a short period of time and set up a wee media apparatus and somebody to run it, and then move on to the next area. So, you know, just move on and plant radio show hosts and new radio stations and new TV and stuff like that. Just all cheap, somebody doing it from home, virtually no cost involved whatsoever with a bare minimum of equipment. And then from that, after I return back home to New Zealand after this world tour or whatever, there's suddenly a global network full of independent people who don't need me to help them, who can report their own news.
Self-redundancy.
That's my goal, is to make myself redundant.
Well, that's what we all want to do, really. We want to put seeds. I think it's an excellent idea. I mean, this is what I consider myself to be, an intellectual terrorist, in that I put seeds in people's minds to make them think. And what is happening now, people are going out there and taking my books and taking my ideas, and there's thousands of them around the world. We even have a term for ourselves. We call ourselves Itladians. And Itladians is the initials of my first book, Is Their Life After Death? And if you go on the web and you look up the term Itlad, it's out there. It's out there in the megasphere. You know, everybody's talking about it at the moment. Now, I want to focus in very, very quickly. I notice in the chat room there's been a couple of fascinating questions that I really am keen to just get my teeth into here, because somebody's actually asked, how does our brain process the images we see in meditation with our eyes closed? Fantastic question. I'm actually now finishing my next book, which will be out, I think, in probably about 6 or 7 months' time. And in this book, I'm dealing with inner light. I'm dealing with the light that is drawn up from the zero-point field. Now, I don't know if people are aware out there, but inside the cells of the body is something called bioluminescence. And bioluminescence is light photons that are actually given off by cells. Now, this light is actually generated by DNA. Now, effectively, DNA, I am arguing in the new book, is intelligent. DNA is an entity. DNA, it guides us. And in fact, if you look, if anybody out there has ever taken ayahuasca and has written and has read the books of people like Jeremy Narby, you will discover some fascinating information about how people encounter in ayahuasca dreams snakes.
Speaking of which, what do you call somebody who has a bad reaction and gets really aggressive when they take it? Ayahuasca the Grouch.
I like it. I like it. That's good. But going back to the subject of inner light, I argue that if you look through the history of esoteric beliefs and mystical beliefs, there is always this idea of the inner light, the light that comes from within. And I argue in my book, and again, I'm doing the science in the new book, is to how this inner light is generated. Now, somebody's asked an even more fascinating thing, the lost sense of time in altered states of consciousness. My second to last book was called The Labyrinth of Time. And in this book, I deal with exactly that. I'm absolutely fascinated by subjective time experience. Why it is time seems to dilate under certain circumstances, it seems to slow down. Arguably, this is brought about by a substance in the brain called glutamate. Glutamate is the major neurotransmitter of the mammalian brain. It is also known to slow down time. Again, some of your clubbers out there will probably, if you've actually ever been in the K-hole and taken ketamine, you will know this is exactly what ketamine does. So does dimethyltryptamine. So does various other mind-altering substances, terms that are generally known as entheogens. Entheogens are actually drugs that let you acquire or see the universe from the point of view of God, for want of a better term. Somebody's asked about this. The compression of this now, how is it we're losing the day relative to a few years ago? I think the answer to that is we're aging. We're all aging, so therefore, as you get older, time slows down for you. And this is a fascinating idea as to why this may be. And there's been various work done on this. And the argument is that as we get older, the amount of time that we have had to build up experiences means that things that are unique are less unique, in the sense that when you're very, very young, everything is new. It's like it's the holiday concept, isn't it? You go on holiday, and you're away on holiday, and the holiday seems to last forever because everything's new and unique. Whereas in your everyday life, things are less than unique, and therefore time seems to slow down for you. That's one alternative explanation. The other explanation is that it is to do with your body temperature. As your metabolic body temperature gets higher, your perception of time slows down. Time seems to slow down when you have a fever. And this, again, is directly linked to the neurology of the brain. Now, again, something that really intrigued me was the idea of time slows down when you're under periods of stress, which, again, is a known fact. There's probably listeners out there who will relate to this so strongly. You're in a car crash. You get given bad news. Time just suddenly slows down and to a certain extent can even stop with certain individuals. This is because time is a subjective experience. It's the only thing I know that's measured by itself. You can have a pound of apples, but you can only have a minute of a minute. You and I could both agree that a clock time minute has taken place, but the reality of the situation is our perception of that minute could be completely and utterly different. And people confuse a clock time. A clock is measuring distance. It's not measuring time. It's not measuring duration. If you look at a clock, it's moving from, say, the 12 to the quarter past. That's distance. It's not time. You know, even Einstein said that, you know, one of the biggest illusions is time. In the quantum world, time could go backwards or forwards. For instance, again, this is something that a lot of people are probably not aware of, positrons. You know, you have these positron emission devices in hospitals, PET scans. Most people aren't aware of what a positron is. A positron is an electron going backwards in time. It's a positive electron. Paul Dirac came up with this conclusion back in the late 1930s. And indeed, there is a guy that's come up with something called a transactional interpretation of quantum physics that says that reality is actually brought about by positrons reacting with electrons. And the present moment is literally created by the interaction of forward time moving electrons reacting with backwards time positrons.
And they cause an interference. Does that mean if you, let's say it's like water, okay, two different streams of water, one coming from the left, one coming to the right, and when they come together, they forge a fountain that pushes together and then upwards, right, like a geyser. That's the backward moving through time, the forward moving through time. If you change the current or if you manage to divert that flow, would it be possible for you to travel down either of those currents, like to travel back up them and ignore the other part of it?
You possibly could do, but the issue with this is to where you would go. Now, I don't know if you've come across Everett's Many Worlds Interpretation of Particle Physics. It was put forward by... Okay, Hugh Everett III was a research PhD student. And in 1957, he did his PhD thesis trying to explain the mysteries of something called the Schrödinger's cat experiment. And it would take me a long, long time to explain this. But effectively, what it is trying to explain is that if you take the implications of the classical interpretation of particle physics, as suggested by people like Niels Bohr and Born and de Broglie and various other researchers in the 1920s, the 1930s, reality comes into existence by the point of observation or the point of measurement. It's called the measurement problem. For instance, if you take a light beam and you don't measure it, it's a light beam. The moment you try to measure a light beam, it becomes a point particle. It changes from a wave to a photon. Now, the difference between a photon is a particle, whereas a wave is a disturbance in another medium. Okay? They've done these experiments time and time again. It's called the twin slit experiment. And if you want any reductionist scientist to have a heart attack, just ask him about the observer problem and the twin slit experiment, and he will bullshit you and he'll try and get around it all. But the point of the fact is absolutely, totally known, and it is the fact that the act of measurement makes the wave turn into a particle. Now, not only this, but these experiments have recently been done with molecules, large molecules. There's a guy called Anton Zeilinger at the University of Vienna. And again, I could be bullshitting you here. Just look it up on the web. This stuff is kept very, very secret because people don't want the masses to know it. Zeilinger has discovered that very, very large molecules, something like called a buckyball. A buckyball has 60 atoms in it. It's a huge spherical molecule. They have found that this molecule, when it's not observed, is a wave. The moment a consciousness takes it into account, it becomes a particle. The world you see around you is made up of molecules. Everything we see is made up of molecules. Molecules do not exist if you don't look at them. This is what Einstein said when he said he did not believe that the moon wasn't there when he looked at it. It's because he could not accept the implications of the Copenhagen interpretation. Now, what Hugh Everett III did was he came along and he said, I have a solution to this. He said, because what happened was Erwin Schrödinger came up with a thought experiment, and he said, if particles only become into existence at the act of observation, what happens to something that's unobserved? And he said, imagine you place a cat in a sealed box, and inside that box is a group of particles that are attached to a sensor with a little hammer that will open up a glass, a little hammer which will smash a glass full of cyanide. If the particle reacts in a certain way, the cyanide is released and the cat dies. If the particle doesn't act in a certain way, the cat survives. Schrödinger said that means that in any period of time, if it's unobserved, the cat is both alive and dead in the box at the same time. What Everett said was that when the box is opened, splits into two scientists. One sees a dead cat and one sees a live cat. Okay, very difficult concept to grasp, and all I suggest
Can I provide the analogy here? There was a story about Columbus coming into the Caribbean, and at the time the peoples of the Caribbean had never seen a sail ship or anything like that, and they were incapable of perceiving it whatsoever. And even when the ship was right in front of them, they still couldn't see it, and it took Sharman to, in fact, help the others before they could even see what was really there. That's not anything like what you're talking about, is it?
To a certain extent, it is. I mean, I always think that story is somewhat apocryphal in that it's done the rounds. My argument would always be who actually asked the Amerindians at the time or the Native Americans at the time whether they saw the ships or not. But it is an extension of something called the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. And the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis is that our language modifies the way we perceive reality. In other words, if you don't have a word for something, you won't necessarily perceive it. For instance, Hopi Indians, Edmund Lee Sapir, when he did his analysis of Hopi Indians, found that the grammatical form of Hopi language means that an object's verb, a verb attached to an object, changes dependent upon the object's shape rather than its color. So young Hopi Indians, this was in the 1930s, would define the world by shapes. So in other words, they perceive the world quite differently to the way we do. And the argument is that our language structures the way we perceive reality. But if there's an argument to say that if we cannot categorize something, if we see something, we cannot categorize it. Or no, more arguably, if we see something and we can categorize it in something we understand it to be, that's where we'll place the category. Whereas the reality might be completely different. For instance, we were talking earlier on offline about UFOs. You know, there could be an argument to say that UFOs do exist. It's just that we are perceiving them in completely the wrong way. Our facilities for understanding our mental structures cannot comprehend exactly what they are.
Well, you know, and I think that this is a phenomenon that many people go through during their lives. You see something, you don't know what it is, you don't understand it, and it just doesn't register. And then somebody later on down the track, a few years later, says, hey, man, do you remember seeing that thing with da-da-da-da-da? And you're like, oh, my God, yeah. I never thought about it like that. I probably shouldn't have gone to public school in the first place. We'll be right back after the break of the Venetian show.com.
Just in time, head down the 405. Gotta meet the new boss by 8 a.m. The phone rings in the car. The wife is working hard. She's running late tonight again. Well, I know what I've been told. You gotta work to feed the soul. But I can't do this all on my own. No, I know I'm no Superman.
Welcome back.
I'm no Superman.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. I'm not Superman, but laser beams do shoot out of my eyes when I see David Rockefeller. There's two guys sitting in a bar at the top of Empire State Building, and one guy's a bit drunk, and he turns to the other guy and he says, "Hey, you know what, man? That you see that window over there? If you jump out it, there's this wind current that'll blow you all the way around the building and then pop you straight back through the window." The other guy's like, "What? Really?" It's like, "Yeah, man. So look, watch." You know, guy drunkenly stumbles to the window and jumps out of it. Sure enough, gust of wind travels him all the way around, and he pops back through the window. He says, "Yeah, see, I told you." And the other guy goes, "Man, that looks pretty fun." So he jumps out the window. He goes, "Aah!" All the way to the ground. The bartender looks at this drunk guy and he goes, "Superman, you're really mean when you're drunk." Right, now
we were talking before, I thought you were going to go with one of the other Superman jokes there, but this is
a family show. FCC regulated radio. We can't even say, we have to say the words BS. In fact, I had to remind you of that earlier, but I forgot. You were talking about Philip K. Dick, the sci-fi writer.
Get that bleeped out for a start, won't you?
Now, Philip K. Dick, I heard this interesting story about him. I think it was in his biography or something, but he had written a book, and when he was writing the book, he was actually taking speed. And in fact, he'd written quite a number of books, allegedly, like he churned out like 3-4 books in a year or something like that while he was taking copious quantities of methamphetamine. And one of these books involved a character that walked into a convenience store to buy some milk, and he starts having a conversation with this character, and it turns out that the person serving him is actually his cousin, a long-lost cousin or relative or something of that nature. And it's like, wow, that's amazing. And about a year later, Philip walks into a convenience store to get a bottle of milk, and he looks at the guy behind the counter, and he's familiar to him, and after a little conversation ensues, and it turns out he's his relative, exactly as he said in the book about a year earlier. So, again, my thoughts are that there's something about drugs, meditation, higher spiritual awareness, and something like that that we're capable of tapping into. It's kind of like a room with not four walls, but four doors and four separate locks. And it doesn't matter which one of those doors you unlock, you still get into the room.
It's the concept of the doors of perception, the William Blake stroke Aldous Huxley concept, and the idea that we have areas of access and the universe out there is far greater and far more interesting than our senses tell us. Now, a guy called Henri Bergson, who was a French philosopher in the late 19th century, considered that the human brain was an attenuator. It was a suppression device. In other words, the brain suppresses the information that we receive all the time. In other words, as William Blake said, if the doors of perception were cleansed, we'd see the world as it really is, infinite. So the idea is that most of us spend all our time stuck. I use the analogy, it's not directly original, but I have used it. A guy called Rainer Johnson was a British physicist who actually emigrated to Australia. And he became schizophrenic towards the end of his life. And he used the analogy called the Irish Round Tower analogy. And I've adopted this because what I consider is that most of us have lived our lives in one of those tall, round Irish towers. And there are five windows. And the five windows are how we perceive reality. When you become schizophrenic, or when you start to experience temporal lobe epilepsy, possibly when you experience classical migraine, it's like you found a trapdoor in the roof, and you open up the trapdoor and you see the universe as it really is for the first time. It's again the universe behind the universe. Philip K. Dick would very much agree with this. Philip K. Dick argued that we were all trapped in something he called the black iron prison. Again, it was something that William Blake called the mind-forged manacles. And it's, again, going back to the analogy of Plato's cave. It's the idea that we don't see reality as it fully is. We are restricted by, as we were saying earlier on, by our processing, by our social mores and everything else, but even more so by the way we perceive reality.
Just to clarify that, if that is the case, if the brain is designed to block those gates, if it's programmed to do so, then what is responsible for that design? What is responsible for that programming that blocks that perception?
I think we're evolving. I think it's a question of evolution, like everything else is. But effectively, if we perceive reality as it really was before we are mentally prepared to understand it, it will drive us insane. This is my argument as to why schizophrenics become insane in raised commas. It's because they're perceiving reality as it really is. Now, there was a guy called David Bohm who was an American professor who was ostracized out of America during the McCarthy era and ended up working in London. And he came up with some wonderful ideas about quantum physics. One of the things he argued in quantum physics that there's something called the implicate order. And the implicate order is the reality behind the reality, the reality between the subatomic particles. And this is what people who, when they acquire schizophrenia, they see the nuts and bolts of how the universe is created. They see the holographic reality that we live within, because it's holograms. It's holographically generated. In fact, a guy called Carl Pribram did work on the brain and came to the conclusion that the brain also works holographically, because this is the only way they can explain how memories work within the brain. I don't know if you're aware of this, but they've never actually found the storage location of memories. They know that probably the amygdala or the hippocampus is somewhere that generates, that processes memory in some way, but they don't know where the memory storage is. And a guy called Carl Lashley did a series of experiments where he taught rats how to go around a maze, and he cut bits of their brains out. And every time he cut a different bit of the brain out, the rat still found its way around the maze. He was looking for something called the Enneagram, the location of memory. And the reason you can do that is it's stored holographically. It's stored all over the brain. Or there's an argument to place. It's not even stored in the brain at all. There's a field of information.
Yeah. That was what I was going to say, is that if there is enough information in there, like, you know how everybody compares the human brain to the computer and how brains are infinitely more complex, they've got more connections than this, that, or the other, blah, 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 blah. It's infinitely complex, so we think, oh, it can do anything. And I thought, maybe what if it's a different dimension? Like, let's say we've got 3D here and 4D right beside here. What if memories are stuck in the 4D and they can just be brought down by your brain? It's just a technical thing, you know? It just taps in and just goes, okay, I've experienced this once upon a time. That experience doesn't exist anymore, but it's still within the ether field or whatever. And so I draw that memory down, boom, there it is. So that way it doesn't matter how much of my brain you remove, you can't remove my memories. But then again, there's those other times where people have received brain injuries and gotten amnesia and things of that nature. So there's definitely a connection there between the brain's ability to download information and what it's physically capable of. Like if it's damaged in some ways, it can stop that from happening. But of course, as you said with the rats, there's a little bit of an in-between, like an unexplained part here that perhaps we don't yet fully understand.
There's a lot of unexplained areas about the brain. For instance, there was a guy called John Lauber who discovered there was a young guy who, I think it was after he died, I'm not sure whether he died or whether they found this out by other means, but he had water on the brain. And he had only around about 5% of brain matter, and yet he'd managed to get a degree in maths. Now, effectively, that throws all the ideas about the brain in the way it functions. Now, I argue, and I will be arguing in my next book, that we're misunderstanding the process of the brain. What the brain is made up of billions and billions of synapses, neurons, and these synapses and neurons have within them really small structures called microtubules. And within the microtubules, something called the microtubercular lattice. And the amount of information that could be processed within all these interactions is phenomenal. But it's a processor. It's your random access memory. It's not the real deal. And what
The cloud. You know how they're talking about now about these iPods and iPads and stuff like that? There's the wireless cloud. What if there is a wireless cloud that we've all got access to, but we just need our brain to be tipped into the iPad setting in order to harvest it?
Spot on. It's called the Akashic Field, the Akashic Record, the Akashic Field. A guy called Irvin Laszlo, who is a professor who, you know, wrote the foreword, actually, to my last book on the out-of-body experience. And Laszlo has written a fascinating series of books on something he calls the Akashic Record, or the Akashic Field. And I'm adapting this, and what I'm saying is that, you know, I was talking about light, and single photon light generated by the brain itself. I think this light is drawn up from this Akashic Record, this Akashic Field. And the Akashic Field is the quantum vacuum. The quantum vacuum, otherwise known as the zero-point field. And again, I'm in regular contact with a guy called Professor Bernard Haish, who's an astrophysicist.
And Anthony, we're coming to break now. Anthony, ladies and gentlemen, you listen to the Vinny Ashton Show. Anthony Peak from anthonypeak.com. We'll be right. Number two, ladies and gentlemen, of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio with my very special guest, Anthony Peak from anthonypeak.com. That's Peak with an E on the end. Incidentally, how do the Chinese government spy on people in restaurants? With the Peking duck. All right, Anthony, welcome back.
Hi. There's been one or two interesting questions in the chat room which I'd just like to pick up on. Somebody's actually asked, somebody called Eric has asked, is the quantum vacuum also called the non-locality matrix? Non-locality is something quite different. Non-locality is the idea that subatomic particles can be what is called entangled. And when subatomic particles are entangled, effectively, if you do one-to-one particle, the other one immediately reacts. It's something to do with the EPR paradox, the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen experiment, thought experiment, which was actually proven in 1981 by a guy called Alain Aspect. So it's quite different, but it is linked in some way. Somebody else is asking about space is a vacuum. Well, interestingly enough, space isn't a vacuum. We are taught at school that space is a vacuum, but it's actually full of cosmic rays and various other bits and pieces. The only real area that we could call a literal vacuum is inside the shell of an atom. And this is where the quantum vacuum actually takes place. In fact, quantum vacuum is something that is the place between subatomic particles. Again, quite a fascinating area if you get the opportunity to read up on this.
When when you talk about it, say a vacuum cleaner or whatever, it creates a vortex which sucks stuff through it. And I was just thinking, is that similar to that that torus design that the Thrive Movement's been talking about?
Very much. The torus is something that I'm in regular conversation with a guy called Joel Baxt, who is an American rabbi, funnily enough. And if you get the opportunity to check out Joel, he is one of the people who is interviewed on the Rick Strassman movie, The Spirit Molecule. And Joel is quite fascinated by the implications of the torus as a shape, in the sense of the way it seems to recurse upon itself. And I'm very much intrigued with the work he's doing. Because it's the idea, isn't it? Like, we have something called Einstein-Rosen bridges, the idea that you can actually have wormholes in space. Now, again, something that I was stunned to recently discover is that Stephen Hawking himself has come to the conclusion that the vacuum of space is actually full of billions and billions of mini black holes, which effectively means that space is sucking itself into itself, which makes this even weirder. You know, the idea of some of the areas of modern quantum physics and some of the areas of cosmology are so weird and so strange that you don't need any new age stuff because it's weird enough as it is. I mean, Stephen Hawking at the moment, his latest work, he's been working with a guy called Thomas Hertog. And the Hawking-Hertog model actually suggests that literally, as we travel through time, we collapse the potentiality of all the alternate futures of every action we can take is out there in potentiality in the zero-point field. And as we take an action, we collapse the wave function of that particular action, and that comes into existence.
I wanted to make a point here as well, because this is something we said on the show before, is, you know, when you make plans, okay, like I'm going from point A to point B, and let's say you get distracted on the way by something, and instead of attending to that distraction, let's say this has happened to me before, a kid who's fallen off their bike on the side of the road and has their pants caught up in the tire thing. So instead of just continuing on my route to go home, I stop the car, unwind the thing for the poor kid, get him up, and show him how to roll up his pants and send him on his way. So I helped somebody, and also I made sure that, or at least gave them the opportunity to learn something about how to make sure that didn't happen again. So I helped them to help themselves as well. Had I, on the other hand, stuck to my plan, I would have prevented myself from that possible meeting, from that possible synchronicity. And this is why I'm willing to, at the drop of a hat, go and start doing off different things. Not a lot of people are like that, though. You know, like 4 minutes' notice is not enough for some people.
I think every action that we do in our lives has so many reactions and so many potentialities that, I mean, funnily enough, one of the people that I'm going to be interviewing my own radio show in November is Danny Rubin. I don't know if you've heard of Danny Rubin. He is the scriptwriter and the brains behind the movie Groundhog Day. And again, if you look at the movie Groundhog Day, you know, the idea of living the same day over and over again and following the potentialities of each day in different ways is effectively what I discuss in my first book, is The Life After Death, The Extraordinary Science of What Happens When We Die. Because we've not really touched upon that in any way. But in that book, I propose a fairly radical idea which explains near-death experience, out-of-the-body experience, experiences, many of the other phenomena that are related to near-death experience, such as the past life review, the meeting with the being of light and everything else. And what I'm suggesting is that at the point of death, we do not have a past life review, you know, my life flashed before my eyes. What we have is a literal life review, in the sense that you relive your life literally second by second, in this matrix-like recreation of your life, drawn up either from the zero-point field, from the memories of that have already been laid down. It's as if you're living in a virtual computer, first-person computer game, an RPG game, whereby everything that can possibly happen in your life is already programmed in there. So when you start living the life the second time, there's a part of you that remembers and almost becomes your game player. So you're almost the sprite on the screen. And you live your life again, but you don't know what's going to happen. You're not know there's a big monster that's going to come around the corner. But effectively, your game player watching you on the screen does. And I call that being your daemon. You on the screen is your Eidolon. As you go down the path, The daemon will warn you about things that you got wrong last time. You know, sometimes you get this kind of feeling you shouldn't do something. You know, that kind of strong sensation of, I shouldn't do this. This is your daemon warning you. And in my second book, The Daemon, A Guide to Your Extraordinary Secret Self, I do the neurology of this, of how this can be possible. So imagine the scenario that over
That voice telling me not to do things, I call it having a missus.
Yeah, so do I.
That's another thing. Men are always getting themselves into big trouble, and it's our missuses that wound up stopping us from getting into it in the first place if we listen to them, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's like how you can't see things in the fridge. Mm. What is that? You know, you look in the fridge and she said, can you get me the bottle of milk? And you're standing there looking at the fridge and you can't see the thing. And this arm comes over your shoulder and grabs it and says it was there. And I always say, always because it was white. I think the argument with that is that because we are hunter-gatherers, we are used to actually looking at the distance, the belt, looking for potential prey, whereas a woman is programmed to look at a baby in the face because they're detail conscious, whereas we're not. That's a sociological excuse. I think it's just because I'm thick, basically.
Well, the thing is, it can't be that. Because it happens to me too. Every time I've lost something, whether it be my keys or my phone or my wallet, anything, Sarah can find it instantly. Yeah. I'll look for an hour, and I'm the one who put it down there, and I can't even find it.
It's also that ability, if you've done something wrong or you've hit something or something, they've got this antennae and they just know what it is and they'll just go straight to it. It must be your body language. It must be that we're not quite as evolved as they are, and we're more basic creatures. I don't know. It intrigues the hell out of me. It really does.
My mother told me an experience with my brother. He was dressing up like Batman, as kids do. This is like in the mid-80s or something. And he was about to jump off the garage. Mum was on the other side of the property, like, clear hundreds of meters away. There's no way she could have physically known that he was up there or seen him or heard him or anything. But she knew, absolutely knew, that he was about to jump off the garage. And walked over there and she caught him as he fell.
She knew that because she had lived this life before and her daemon reminded her a split second before that something was terrible was going to happen. And last time round, your brother was probably injured. This time round, she goes and she catches him. Now, I can give an example of this. In my book, The Labyrinth of Time, which is my book on time, I give an example of me literally catching my wife, Penny, as she fell downstairs. Now, on Facebook, if you go onto Facebook and you go onto my Facebook site, Anthony Peake, and you go onto my videos, there's a video on there where I videoed the distance I was able to travel when I heard her scream. So I hear her scream, I get up, run, something would take me 4 seconds to get to see her in midair coming down, and I managed to catch her. That was impossible. Either I dilated time, I picked up some kind of feeling or sensation. But that's the daemon in action. As somebody's turned around here and said, is the daemon my guardian spirit or your guardian angel? Yes, it is. It's known as many, many things. But it's that being that talks to you and warns you. Because one of the great mysteries has always been, how does your guardian angel know what mistakes you're going to make? It knows because it's lived your life before.
People interpret that voice or that synchronicity or whatever as God. But what if it's not God? What if it's you?
It is you. It is you. It's your higher self. It is your what I would call, without being causing great confusion here, it is your immortal self. It's not your soul, but it's your self that exists outside of time. Now, in my latest book, I'm actually coming to an even bigger idea. And I mean, somebody's put it now, Rupert Sheldrake, somebody called Orbic, morphogenic resonance and morphic resonance. This is exactly what I'm talking about here. There's a field out there, and we attune into this field. But there's more to it than that. We are part of a greater something. We are part... Bill Hicks, famous monologue, the American comedian, when he turns around and says, breaking news, young man on LSD realizes that all matter is energy moving at a slower speed. And he also realizes that we are all one consciousness experience itself subjectively. This is what is happening. We are one single consciousness. This is how morphic resonance happens. I met Rupert Sheldrake, by the way, a few weeks ago, and I was discussing this with Rupert about the idea of this and how this can work. It makes sense. We're all the same being. It's just that we're not aware of it. We have what Philip K. Dick called amnesia. And amnesia is something where you awaken to the fact that we're all one single entity. And the daemon is a manifestation of that single entity. The daemon is your higher self. The daemon is the part of you that's lived the life. The larger being, well, I term the uber daemon, the higher self, as it were. But this theme goes back, it goes back through every civilization. It goes back through every religious belief, every philosophical belief has this as its basic core. You go back to the Gnostics, you go back to the Kabbalah, you go back to Sufism, all the mystic belief systems, Buddhism, they all have this concept of the higher self. Even the Huna, the Polynesian Huna on the Hawaiian Islands, have two beings, and the Huna have got it absolutely nailed, where they turn around and they say that your higher self is given to you at your birth, and it knows your life because it's lived your life before. I do the science of how this can work, and it makes sense. And the reason why my first book has now sold the thousands of copies it has and has been translated into so many different languages, people read it and they go, wow, this makes sense. I don't have to go and believe New Age nonsense. This is giving it to me using basic neurology, basic particle physics, and basic things we know, and just extrapolating the neurology a little bit further by the experiences that people have.
Can we go back to that concept that I talked about, the cloud, the digital wireless network that we've got access to if we've got iPads, receivers capable of picking them up? So does that mean I wonder what the point of download is. Like, you know, when you're conceived, sperm hits the egg. Is that the point that the wireless field is activated for that particular embryo, and it then opens itself up to be, I guess, possessed? Might be too nasty a word, but incorporated, perhaps?
The neurology and the physiology suggests that it's the 49th day of gestation that happens.
Why the 49th day?
Okay, the 49th day for two reasons. The first one is, this is what the Buddhists believe is when the soul enters the body. But there is another more practical reason. And it seems, and I'm checking up on this because I'm discussing this with various physiologists, but the information I've been given by an associate of mine, Beach Barrett, and various other individuals, is that at the 49th day of gestation, the pineal gland, or the pineal body, together with the pituitary gland, is actually based at the back of the throat. And at that point, it moves up to the center of the brain, okay? That's the point where we start to become human, as it were. Now, what is intriguing about this is the pineal gland, I believe that the pineal gland is the place that generates endogenous, that is internally generated dimethyltryptamine, okay? It generates...
DMT.
We know that the pineal gland excretes something called melatonin. Melatonin is very, very similar chemically to dimethyltryptamine, okay? As is serotonin. Now, we know that dimethyltryptamine has been found in the blood. We know it's been found in the gut. We know that it's been found in brain material. So it's endogenous. It's actually made by the body. Even though it's made in plants, it's made by the body. Now, if that is the case, there is something that people call the nectar of transcendence. It's something when people go into deep trance states, they feel an acid taste in the back of their throat. What is suggested is, this is dimethyltryptamine dripping down the duct that is left at the back of the throat. And this is why people, for millennia, have believed this. In my research, in my latest book, I'm surprised that it goes back to real ancient traditions, this belief in this nectar, this taste, this acidic taste. And it's dimethyltryptamine. Now, I'm doing work at the moment with two Austrian researchers. One's a consultant neurologist and one's a consultant psychologist, Dr. Engelbert Winkler and Dr. Dirk Prokol. And these guys have invented a machine called the Lucid Light device. Now, I've tested this machine, and again, if you check out on my website, on my forum, and everywhere else, I have lots of information about this. This machine forces the brain to the pineal gland to generate dimethyltryptamine.
Hold on. We're coming to break now. But if that machine can force you to produce that is a breakthrough in and of itself. We'll be right back after the break with Anthony Peake, anthonypeake.com, at the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com.
Black sunrise, shadow coming over the sky. Black sunrise, always gonna be a surprise, 'cause we don't know.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the sunny slave South Pacific Island, changed nation of New Zealand. Anthony Peake, 6 books. Mate, you must do a heck of a lot of writing. You know, I tried to start writing a novel when I was like 14, I think. I got up to page 75, and then the computer crashed, and I lost about 50 pages of it. And then I gave up. Yeah. Anything like that happened to you?
Worst thing in the world. I back up every 20 minutes, and I've got the copies of the books on every single media you can imagine, because the archons will get you if they don't like what you're doing. And it has happened to me once, and you can never recreate what you've written, however hard you try. It's even when you're just doing a posting on Facebook and the damn thing doesn't work, and that really frustrates you. Just a very quick point as well. There's some interesting comments being made here on the general chat board as well. And somebody's actually Frank Tipler. They've mentioned Frank Tipler and Robert Lanza. Yeah, Tipler's Omega Point, his book The Physics of Immortality, is a fascinating idea. There's also somebody else that's actually mentioned Nick Bostrom as well, another theorist about reality as simulation. Some great stuff out there and some interesting comments on there. Really intriguing. So thanks for these. It's really good.
Okay. And I wanted to take this in a slightly different direction as well. A more personal note and about yourself in particular, because a lot of researchers and activists, when they're on radio or the rest of the place, it's about their research and things of that nature, and it's not quite a personable thing. You don't really get to know quite who they are as people, because they're talking about research and things that they've done rather than their personal experiences and things that have happened to them in their life that have kind of changed the course of it, so to speak. And in my experience, when it comes to activists or people who get into alternative fields, it's usually one or two reasons, like either your parents are of that persuasion and they instill it in you from a young age, and so it kind of becomes an inevitability that you'll become who you have become. The other one is you either become very successful in the current system, but you get, shall we say, access to a bit much information than you thought was there in the first place, and you kind of had to do a backtrack and come all the way back around again. Either of those resonate with you?
Not really. I mean, people regularly ask me, you know, what on earth stimulated you to write what you do? And my response to that is my daemon, although I didn't know it at the time. I can't remember which book it is now, I mention it, but I mention a series of very, very bizarre synchronicities, because that's another subject that I am fascinated by, took place as I was researching the first book. And not only that, but I found that references I had needed for the book were already there. And I'll cite one example, which is very, very strange. I was needing, at the time of writing the first book, I went into some very, very interesting areas. And one of the areas I became fascinated with was mitochondrial DNA. It's the DNA that's carried through the female line. And I have thousands of books, and I needed a reference. So I went to my bookcase, and I thought, who is likely to have written about mitochondrial DNA? And I thought, Richard Dawkins. Now, I have all of Richard Dawkins' books, and I thought, probably if any of his books, it's going to be The Blind Watchmaker. So I took The Blind Watchmaker out. Now, I had read that book once, around about 9 years before, on holiday in Greece. And I've not read it since. Now, one of the other things I never do with books is dog-ear pages. It's something I do not do. I took the book out, and as I took the book out, I noticed that one page had been dog-eared by my earlier self 9 years before, just as I'd gone to lunch, I guess, off the beach. I knew with absolute certitude what was going to be on that page. And I opened the page, and there it is on the page. It's dog-eared, and it's the page. Now, again, if anybody's interested, there is a DVD available called The Anthony the Peak Experience. And it's available. You can buy copies off my website and everything else. I can give you a link to the producers of the movie. And in this, I'm interviewed by a British actress called Margie Clark. And in the video, I actually show that particular example, and I actually show the paperback and the page that was actually done. Now, it was little things like that that happened continually that led me to... I was almost led by the nose to write this book. I felt it wrote itself. It was very, very strange, because I didn't expect to write a book explaining near-death experience. I started off with just an explanation of what deja vu was, because I had deja vu experiences all my life, and they confused the hell out of me. I wanted to know exactly what this sensation was, whereby I sense that I have experienced something before. Simply that. And I came across a wonderful paper written by a guy who now is on my forum, and in fact runs the deja vu section, a guy called Dr. Arthur Funkhauser, who is a world expert in the deja phenomenon. And interestingly enough...
I must say how cool it is to know that there's a guy named Funkhauser who's all about deja vu.
Do you know, art gets this all the time. It really does. Funnily enough, I did an interview. I regularly used to do interviews on a program on BBC Radio Merseyside over in the UK. And, well, in the UK, here. And on my very first program, Art phoned in from Switzerland. And he phoned in, and the DJ that was doing the program is a fairly well-known local celebrity called Billy Butler. And Billy's very, very Liverpudlian, very, very Scouse. And when Art phoned up, he turns around and he goes, "All right, Art, how are you?" He said, "Do you know what? When you sang Bridge Over Troubled Water, you were absolutely fantastic. Why did you ever split up with Paul Simon?" And Art, being an American, didn't necessarily get necessarily what he was doing. Art all seriously goes, "I think you mean Paul Simon. I think you mean Art Garfunkel. I'm Art Funkhauser." And it was just classic radio. Classic radio. But Art has something called a dream interpretation of deja vu. And it's wonderful. And it's so simple. He turns around and he says, "You've had a dream recently. And you start to experience the dream in real life. And you recognize it like you recognize memories from a dream." And as I pointed out to him when I met him, and I said, the one problem with that, Art, because Art is a quantum physicist. He's got a PhD in laser physics. And I said, it's all well and good as an explanation, But it flies in the face of science, because what it's saying is that it's a precognition. What else can it be? If you have a dream and then the dream starts to become real in real life, it cannot be anything but a precognitive experience. And if time only flows forwards, backwards, forwards, if time flows as we think it does in one direction, precognition is impossible, because if the future is yet to happen, how can we know about it? But we do consistently. Precognition is so common. I've had precognitive dreams. I will guarantee that probably 50% of the people listening out there have had precognitive dreams. The problem is you can't prove them.
Who was it that said that history doesn't repeat itself, but it sure does rhyme?
I don't know.
I think it was... who was the guy who wrote Tom Sawyer?
Mark Twain.
I think that was him.
Sounds like Mark Twain. Nietzsche, that great humorous German character as well, had some great jokes about the Eternal Return.
And there was another one by Oscar Wilde, I think. He says, we're all living in the gutters, but at least some of us are looking at the stars.
In the stars. I love that one, yeah. And what I really like about Oscar Wilde is his last words. Do you know what his last words were?
No.
Either those curtains go or I do. it's classic, absolute classic.
There was another part. You referenced Bill Hickok saying about how a young man on acid now realised that all energy is condensed to a slow vibration and that we are all one. But you missed the last part of it was there is no such thing as death.
Yeah.
Do you believe that to be true, that death is, as people perceive it, like the body becomes lifeless and that person just kind of vanishes? That's at least the conventional scientific belief, that once that entity that is you and the physical form is gone, it will not return. Yet we have a remarkable amount of instances all over the planet where people will be born and they will remember a life in a city with a family very, very specifically, hundreds and hundreds of miles away, right? Have you ever, heard stories like this?
Examples of reincarnation. It's a lot of the main work was done by a guy called Ian Stevenson at the University of West Virginia, can be very, very beguiling and can be very, very powerful. However, one of the things that intrigues me about a lot of the cases, particularly the cases in India, is that you very rarely, if ever, get a case of somebody claiming to be reborn from a lower caste into a higher caste. In other words, it's always somebody who has pecuniary advantage by claiming that they were reborn as somebody else. That doesn't.
Well, I wonder if by extension it means that if you die wealthy, you haven't learned a whole lot, and you need to come back as a poor person in order to complete your mission.
My position on this is the collective consciousness bit, the idea that under certain circumstances you can tune in to the Akashic field, the Akashic record, the collective consciousness of humanity that's ingrained in your DNA. For instance, DNA itself downloads programs of itself. Every time a cell splits, DNA puts a copy of itself into RNA. So effectively, there are memories there within our genetic makeup. So it could be circumstances whereby we remember because we have these memories within ourselves. Now, that doesn't discredit reincarnation, far from it, because there is still a fair degree of beguiling evidence. In fact, an associate of mine, Alan Bates, is a professional hypnotic regressionist, and he does a stage show where he regresses people. And he's had some very, very intriguing results in terms of this. But for me, the concept of death and the reason why I have this idea of death is my cheating ferryman put forward in the first book, is that if we do fall out of time at the end of our life and we live our life again and again and again in a matrix-like recreation of our life, we are in effect for ourselves immortal. Take, for example, people die in time, don't we? In other words, if you drop dead in front of me now, you will die. If in my world, in my universe, I will see you die. But imagine as you're falling to the floor with your heart attack, your time, your final second suddenly becomes 80 years. In your mind, you never hit the floor. And in point of fact, at the end of that life, you will have another life and another life and another life, in which case you will never die. The thing is, time is the thing that people get confused when they say about life and death. They forget the issue of time. You know, when you wait.
Yeah. What if there was somebody who was, say, a millennia old? Let's do a hypothesis here. A human being somehow has the ability to cheat death in essence. The human body regenerates itself every 7 years, and there's a certain programming as we age that collagen and glutathione and those other things that provide our elasticity and the longevity of our organs. They tend to wane over time, and hence the aging process. Let's say somebody through some freak of nature had been capable of transcending that and lived from, say, Roman times up till today. I wonder if that person would have met people that they recognised throughout the millennia that they had seen before in real life, and not déjà vu, but for real.
There is the idea that the concept of the avatar, the concept of the bodhisattva, somebody who has reincarnated many times, has become a perfect human being, and instead of actually traveling on, they remain here to help us develop. Now, I find that quite beguiling, and the idea that there might be certain individuals who are here to guide us in certain ways. The problem I have with that is that if there are people around us trying to guide us, they're making a really bad job of it.
Either that...
If we have ascended masters, I'm sorry, they're not doing very well.
Well, either that, or they're the real kind of nasty, abusive parents kind of descended masters who think that if they just throw you into a freezing cold lake, you'll figure out how to swim and somehow generate your own body heat to survive, and hopefully that'll harden you the frack up so you can survive the rest of this BS that you have to go through. I don't know. We'll be right back after the break.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I've been to Reno, Chicago, the Eastwood Park, Show. Buffalo, Toronto, that's the reincarnation theme song right here on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And also, my very special guest, Anthony Peake. We've been having some very interesting discussions today, and I don't know, and I've had comments from a lot of the listeners over the last 2 months in particular, and I've noticed it too. There has been a rapid acceleration and a vast improvement both in my abilities and also the quality of the guests that we've been getting. I've noticed it, the listeners have noticed it, and I can put it down to this. You know when somebody sends you a request of something, like, I'll use the example that I told Anthony over the break. Votersofamerica.org sent me an email, I've never heard of these people, by the way, saying, Vinny, we're having problems with our live webcam chats that we broadcast on our website. Can you help us? Now, first thing that came to mind is, do I look like a technical help desk to you? And then the second thing that occurred to me was Mark Dice just recently had started doing live webcam broadcasts through a website called, I forget the name of it. I copied the link and just Googled Mark Dice live webcam. And sure enough, came up with the website where you can just click and start broadcasting for free. Okay. I went there, grabbed the link, sent it back to them and said, hopefully that might help. Now, it took the same amount of energy to come up with an excuse for why I couldn't help them as it did to do a tiny little bit of effort into trying to help them. I may not have solved their problem, but at least I tried, even with no obligation. Positive karma is what we were talking about over the break, and I'm starting to feel as though I'm accumulating lots of it because I'm trying to do as much good for as much people as I can every minute of the day. And sure enough, whenever I need to move house or whenever I need a new piece of equipment, whenever I need some food or some new hand-me-down clothes, or whenever I need somebody to take me out for a night drinking on them or something like that, it happens. This is what I feel the world is meant to be like. If you walk around all day, every day, trying to do as much good for as much people as you can, that way, whenever you need anything from anybody, it shows up. And everybody seems to be working together in a synchronistic, symbiotic circle where nobody has to be alone and nobody has to be down on their luck ever again. At least that's the world that I'd like to try and help influence and create. Anthony Peake is my guest from anthonypeake.com. Man has written 6 books on reincarnation and deja vu and this, that, and the other. So I'd recommend everybody go and check out his website, anthonypeake.com. That's Peake with an E on the end. So, Anthony, final segment. You usually talk about self-censorship and what have you. So if there's anything that you wouldn't ordinarily say, maybe on a radio show or something like that, I'm not sure if this actually applies. In fact, for most of the guests over the last couple of weeks, it's kind of an irrelevant question because they don't self-censor, do they? So you're either going to say something that you wouldn't ordinarily say, or you're going to comment on why people shouldn't self-censor.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think that I will tend to say what I think. Well, no, that's not necessarily true. What I tend to do is to be probably quite careful in what I say, in the sense that I work on the concept that extraordinary claims need extraordinary proofs. So therefore, what you'll find with me when you read my books is that I will always give you the reference to the material I'm quoting. You can go back to the original academic papers, the original articles and such like, and you can make your own decisions upon what I'm saying. As I said, I'm not a guru. I'm not peddling anything. All I'm peddling is for people to think for themselves and come to their own conclusions about the things I write about. This is why on my forum, which is, well, I'd call it my forum, but it's not anymore. It now belongs to the members, which is called cheatingtheferryman.com. And on there, we have discussions and debates about many, many subjects. And we don't censor on there. So as far as I'm concerned, any opinions, and if there's something I say that you disagree with, that's fine. You know, it means I'm wrong. And if I'm wrong, there's something I've misunderstood or misinterpreted. I mean, I'm no expert on everything. So therefore, if you know something that I'm unaware of or an experience somebody's had that counters what I'm saying, please contact me. For instance, I'm not a believer in people having out-of-the-body experiences and floating into the next room. I believe that when somebody has an out-of-body experience, they're actually traveling in alternate realities. And again, that might sound like an extreme point of view, but if you actually look at the research empirical evidence, there is very little, if any, evidence that anybody has ever actually observed anything outside of their body that they couldn't have observed ordinarily simply by cheating, for example, or guessing. You know, and I know people will turn around to me and say, what about Charles Tartt, Miss X? What about people like Ingo Swann and everybody else? Well, I've done the research on these people and spent an awful lot of time researching it, and the evidence is not quite as strong as people would like you to believe. It's the same when people have near-death experiences and they claim that they see things outside of their body, for instance, the Pam Reynolds case and such like. Again, these are very, very beguiling, very, very strong cases until you really look at them in great detail. And as I've always said, and it's not just me, I mean, I can't remember who came up with the original quotation, but the extraordinary claims need extraordinary proofs really does apply here. I know it was Carl Sagan that came out with it, but I think it was an Italian researcher that first came up with the concept. Because we are in a world where we are making extraordinary claims, and we have to prove them. You know, there's no point in me just saying, oh, you know, I've channeled stuff from the planet Tharg. and some ascended master is telling me that this is the case. Well, you know, if you're making those claims, the ascended master should be able to know things that modern science doesn't know. But these ascended masters never seem to do that, do they? They don't ever come up with anything that's any use other than let's all live together and be happy. You know, wouldn't it be better if they actually said, well, here is a compound that you've never actually come across before because I'm such an advanced being, I know about it. That never, ever happens. It also intrigues me why channeled information throughout the centuries only ever channels information pertinent to that culture and that science level. Never anything channeled in advance, you know, which begs the question, you know, what is really happening here? And I really don't know. But I'm open to discussions and arguments on that as well.
Yeah. Well, and again, the point of discussions and arguments, particularly about issues like this, which many people would get emotional. Emotional is the word. They leave their mind behind. They leave the listening part, and they leave the ability to learn behind as well. And they block out this thing which is uncomfortable for them that they do not understand as yet, out of a fear perhaps of being wrong. Personally, I believe that being wrong is one of the most positive things that you can ever encounter, because if you are proved wrong now, it means you were given a choice. There's a great quote, when an honest man is proven wrong, he will either cease to be wrong or he will cease to be honest. And when people cease to be honest with themselves about the experiences that they have or refuse to even acknowledge other people's experiences or other people's research and things of that nature as possibilities at the very least, or just hear them out and humour them, if you're blocking yourself from all information that disagrees with your personal point of view, you are automatically wrong in my view, which is why I assume that everything I know to be true is in fact incorrect. And I assume that somebody will probably produce the evidence that proves just how wrong I am at some point. However, I won't know just how wrong I am until somebody who produces that evidence for me. Until then, I'm going to operate under that assumption, and I'll either be correct about being wrong or I'll be pleasantly surprised that I am right.
Now, again, I agree with you. One of the things that I find the biggest frustrations I have is individuals who come onto the forum or onto Facebook and say to me that what you write is complete kike, but they haven't actually read the book or any of my books. And I say, please read the book, come back to me and point out to me the areas where you think I'm wrong. And all I ever get is, I don't need to waste my money buying your book. I know it's wrong. And surprisingly, many of these people are people who should know better. You know, they're people who are highly intelligent, highly well-read, but they have vested interests in believing what they want to believe. I genuinely do not believe in anything. I'm not a believer. I never have been a believer. I'm a searcher after truth. But I have no axe to grind. You know, my overall ideas, you know, this is why I'm a member of the International Association of Near-Death Studies. And one of the things that frustrates me about that organization is, in general, it exists to prove the survival of consciousness after death. That's what it exists for. So therefore, it is not being objective in any shape or form. In other words, it searches out the supporting material to support its position. That is not scientific. You should take the evidence and follow it to its logical conclusion, even if it is unpalatable, you still need to. It's like people turn around to me and say, you know, my idea that you live your life over and over again and you're reborn as yourself, isn't that terrible? And I always think, no, it's not. Anyway, I'm aware of the fact that we are running out of time. Yet again, another 2 hours has just flown by on our podcast. It's amazing how time dilates.
It is. This is the fastest 2 hours in talk radio, ladies and gentlemen. And if you would like to be intellectually honest with yourself and purchase one of Anthony's books from anthonypeak.com, go for your life. And also,
oh, yeah, by the way, you can get them on Amazon. You can get them in your local bookshop. You don't have to go on my website. You know, they're there and available. Nice. Get them on Kindle. But on Kindle.
Well, yeah. Indeed. All right. Well, thank you, Anthony. And also, we're having a social chat after the break. So if you'd like to join us for 15 minutes with the listeners, be much obliged. We'll see you.
Are you tormented with anxiety, depression, or other chronic symptoms of less than perfect health? In 2010, a few people got to participate in a groundbreaking discovery. Dr. Carolyn Dean, world-renowned authority on natural health, has recently patented a technology that is straight out of science fiction. And she invited me to try this product called RNA Drops. And within 12 hours of taking RNA Drops, I could feel an amazing sense of bliss. And since then, I've watched my troubles with depression and other health issues vanish into freedom and happiness again. Listen to hours of testimonials and get your trial bottle of RNA Drops at www.rnafreebottle.com. That's www.rnafreebottle.com. Look for our ad on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. RNA Drops.
Are you completely fed up with being dependent on those fat cat electricity monopolies that raise your rates again and again? Are you terrified about how you'll keep your home and family safe when a power crisis happens? 123/power.com has set up a free video presentation that exposes the electricity monopolies and government agencies for what they are, incompetent lying crooks that are counting on your ignorance and fear to keep your power bills criminally high. Some have called this a conspiracy. Others have called it a cover-up, and you'll be shocked to find out how deep the conspiracy goes. The video at 123/power.com exposes the truth and shows you the secret to slash your power bill and beat the electricity monopoly for good. Watch the controversial video that thousands of other smart patriots have already seen in the last 3 months. Go to 123/power.com and discover one weird trick to cut your power bill and protect your home. Easy to remember, 123/power.com. Go watch the video now before they shut it down. Again, that's 123/power.com.
I have this feeling, man, because you know there's a handful of people actually run everything. That's true. It's provable. Handful, very small elite run and own these corporations, which include the mainstream media. I have this feeling who's ever elected president, like Clinton was, no matter what your promises you promise on the campaign trail, blah, 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 when you win, you go into this smoky room with the 12 industrialists, capitalist scum f***s who got you in there, and you're in this smoky room and this little film screen comes down. And a big guy in a cigar rolled the film. And it's a shot of a Kennedy assassination from an angle you've never seen before. That looks suspiciously off the grassy knoll. And then the film, the screen goes up and the lights come up and they go to the new president. Any questions? Just what my agenda is. First we bomb Baghdad. You got it.
Do you realize every day we are being put under constant stress from wireless radiation? What's worse is that you don't even know that it's happening. It puts as much stress on our body as if we had a constant viral infection, draining our energy and sapping our strength, or just making us irritable and fatigued. These wireless fields are being emitted from computers, microwaves, mobile phones, power lines, and any electrical appliance. Now there is a solution. A group of research engineers in New Zealand have come up with an active shielding device that shields you from wireless radiation at a cellular level. BlueShield comes in three models, a household, portable, and USB that plugs into any computer. The great thing about BlueShield is it is very affordable and guaranteed to last. A one-off purchase will see you being protected for years to come. Visit AmericanFreedomRadio.com and click on the BlueShield banner. BlueShield, brought to you by the VinnieEastwoodShow.com.
No rules, no rules, no taboo topics, no taboo topics, no fear of doom, no fear of doom. We are American Freedom Radio. American Freedom Radio.